right now an opportunity to engage in a little civil discourse about the nature of society with Oscar Ness, a man who has a long tradition of, as a culture critic, Christian evangelical intellectual, visiting Australia recently for a conference on education in Christian schools in Darwin. We took the opportunity to have a chat with him, and he chose as a piece of music to introduce himself a selection from the first movement of J.S. Bach's Magnificat. The music of Bach. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. Time now to introduce our guest, Oscar Ness. Oscar Ness has the privilege of being connected to a family which has deep history in both evangelical religion and in the brewing industry. We may talk about that a little later on. Oscar Ness, welcome to Sunday night.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on with you, John.
Now, a couple of years ago, you wrote a book called The Case for Civility and Why Our Future Depends on It. Australian politics has been racked over recent years by a discussion very much centred on civility. That is, both parties in politics have been accused of playing the man rather than the issue. We see in the United States the current strife over the budget being played out very much as everybody takes to their own corner and hurls missiles at them. You're suggesting that this is something deeply connected with our civilization, something to be very concerned about.
Well, the trouble is people view civility as a matter of being nice, whereas in fact it's a matter of citizenship and the values and duties of citizenship. And the key issue that underlies it is how on earth do we live with our deep differences when those differences involve things that are ideological and religious? Because, you know, it's said in my field, everyone is now everywhere. It's a little exaggerated, but never before there have been so many people, and they're not just little private religious preferences. They're entire worldviews and entire ways of life, elbow to elbow with other entire worldviews and ways of life. And so the question of how we live with differences goes to the heart of the modern world in almost every country, and civility, properly understood, is the answer.
It goes back to a discussion that I can recall as a young person when Sir Kenneth Clark did that great series Civilization. And I remember at the end of the last episode, he held in his hands a cup and saucer and said, "Much of this comes down to what I would like to describe as manners. That is the way we deal with each other." And to come to the end of that remarkable series and have him distill it into that goes to something of what you're saying also.
But the trouble is people tend to think of it as sort of Japanese tea ceremony etiquette or dinner party etiquette.
Yes.
And manners are incredibly important. But it's deeper things. And I think, for example, to have civility, you need to have the so-called three R's: rights, responsibilities, and respect. So I argue for a civil public square over against a sacred public square where any religion is preferred or established, and certainly over against what's called a naked public square where all religions are excluded and, by default, secularism creeps in. Civility is where every faith, whatever they are, however small or large, is free to enter the public debate based on freedom of conscience, but with a respect for the rights of others. So a right for a Christian is a right for an atheist, is a right for a Jew, and a right for a Mormon, a Muslim, and so on and so on and so on. A right for one is a responsibility for the other.
This is a very difficult thing for civilizational cultures to arrive at. Some people would point to the fact that this idea of tolerance comes very late. In Christian civilization, it emerges with the Enlightenment. It's post-Reformation. It emerges with the Enlightenment. It's something that is a very difficult concept to arrive at.
John, with due respect, you're right that it came late, but it didn't come with the Enlightenment. It came as a response to the wars of religion. That's right. But it was actually the pioneers of people like Roger Williams or William Penn who pioneered earlier still in the 1620s, 30s, 40s, what it meant for people of deep convictions to live together with other people of deep convictions. The Enlightenment really added to that. Personally, I don't like the Enlightenment-favored word, which is tolerance. Tolerance is infinitely better than the opposite, intolerance. But tolerance is usually condescending. The strong tolerate the weak. The majority, the minority, the government, the citizens. It's a sort of grant of the powerful. Whereas religious liberty, freedom of conscience, as Williams and Penn and many of the others understood, it's a right. And it's a much tougher concept. And so I use words like respect, but you're respecting a right, not just tolerating others.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia. We're talking with Os Guinness, the author of The Case for Civility and Why Our Future Depends on It. Os Guinness, there is something you've mentioned two or three times already in our discussion, and that's this the link with religion and the way religion is connected to civil society. Now, this picks up a strand that has been echoed through a number of historians over the years. I think perhaps you could go back as far as Macaulay, come through to people like Arnold Toynbee, but perhaps the pithiest summary of the concept was from an American historian, very popular in the 30s to the 50s, Will Durant, a wonderful quote from Durant. Religion begins by offering magical aid to harassed and bewildered men. It culminates by giving to a people that unity of morals and belief which seems so favourable to statesmanship and art, and it ends by fighting suicidally in the lost cause of the past. Not a bad line.
No, a terrible line. John, the way I put it is this. Three of the greatest questions in our modern world are religious. The first, obviously, will Islam modernize peacefully? The second, hugely important for the future, which faith will replace Marxism in China? The party's in power, the ideology is dead. And the question is, which faith will replace the vacuum?
Civilizations need a faith.
Exactly. Now, but the third great question is, will the West, will it sever or recover its roots? And the roots of the West, contrary, say, to the preamble of the EU Constitution and other things, the roots of the West are decisively Christian. In other words, there are three great civilizations behind the West: Greece, obviously, Rome, obviously, and Israel. But each of those was Mediterranean. And what made the West, in other words, European civilization, was the Christian faith and the conversion of the barbarian people. And we're at the end of what's called the second mission to the West, and if we finally sever our roots, one wonders what the West will become, because clearly we're living in a cut-flower situation. Many people think, we can get rid of religion, we'll still have values and all these good things. No, we won't. And you can see, say, an Australian thinker like Peter Singer. If humans are not made in the image of God, for example, what are human rights? And Singer advocates that handicapped children up to the age of two can be killed because they don't have the quality of life that others have, and so on. You can see these things make an extraordinary difference.
Christopher Hitchens, one of the prophets of contemporary atheism, had an interesting discussion with his brother, Peter, last year. And in going through the transcript of that, and we featured that discussion on this program, Hitchens made a very interesting observation. He made the observation that many have, that the First and Second World Wars, particularly the First World War, marked the end through self-destruction, really, of what had been previously for many years called Christendom. But he also made the interesting point that he, Christopher Hitchens, was not at all sure whether we could survive the absence of what Christendom had provided, that is, an overarching narrative for our civilization. So even he, an atheist, was conceding the point that you're making.
No, I agree. And I think that's the question. So Lord Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal in England, he says it's a 50-50 question whether humankind will survive this century. And if humankind does, it's almost certain that civilization as we know it will not. And so we're in an incredibly important time. For 600 years, for better or worse, the West has been dominant. And now in the global era, we're moving beyond that with so-called multiple modernities. But the question is, what are the roots of so many of these things? So you can see say, science, capitalism, technology. We produce these forces in the West, and they're now running away with us. They've lost, you can look at the Wall Street crisis and so on, they've lost their ethical boundaries.
Well, one only needs to discuss the crisis facing Rupert Murdoch over the last few weeks.
Well, absolutely. The things that some of the News of the World reporters did in England were absolutely grotesque. And you can see that Britain, which in many ways led the world up to the 19th century, today is leading the world in the vulgarity of much of its culture and in the complete absence of culture. You know, consumerism and other values have overtaken everything.
Civility is also linked to a concept called community. That is, it says that at heart we must be relational beings. Community is what is essential, and that is too what is breaking down.
Oh, I think it's long broken down, and individualism has become a kind of atomism. You can see how so much of our modern lifestyle is ending in disastrous cul-de-sacs, and we've got to rethink the way we're going. But the relational crisis is at the heart of it.
And it's a function of both the ideologies of left and right. That is, the right in extreme atomized individual capitalism, where all you are is a unit of consumption and anything that bears against that is a problem. And on the left, the postmodernist relativizing of all values until that you are everything is subjective and everything is a power construct. And ultimately, the only power you have to exercise is your own.
I couldn't agree with you more, John. But I remember Alexis de Tocqueville points out in Democracy in America that at a certain point, the radical individualism becomes very close to the growing statism, what he called the nanny state. No, that's what Maggie Thatcher called the nanny state. He called it the tutelary state. In other words, you have a horseshoe effect. At the extremes, radical individualism actually leads to kind of collectivist answers. You can see in America, the more people get spoiled, indulgent in their individualism, the more they look to the big state to answer all the needs that they're crying out for.
And of course, the contradiction there is exhibited in the current budget crisis in the United States, where people want all the things that the state can provide for them, but at the same time want their taxes reduced so that they can function as freer individuals.
Exactly. But we've got to see that many of these things are not just the product of ideas. Some of them are purely the product of ideas. Much of them are the product of aspects of modernity. You mentioned consumerism. That's a key part. I remember 20 years ago, I was in Singapore giving a lecture, and the respondent to me said, well, that's the, and I'm English, of course, he said, that's the American way. We want the Asian way. We don't want Christ. We want Confucius. And he said, to take an example, we have strong families here in Asia, and we don't want to go your way of radical individualism. And I said, well, let's see what happens when you modernize. Now, you look at China today, and they are bringing in family experts from the West to help solve their family crisis, because the more modern they get, the more individualistic they get, the family structures are breaking down. So it's often not just the product of ideas, but forces in our modern world which are corroding so many of the things that are important. But we have in the gospel itself the answer to some of these profound questions, which you frankly don't have in many of the other philosophies and religions.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. Our guest is Os Guinness, author, among other things, of The Case for Civility and Why Our Future Depends on It. Os Guinness, let's have a piece of music. And we had a little of Bach before. Bach seen by many as perhaps the real flowering of the Reformation and a high point in European culture, bringing together God and man.
Well, I love Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 21 and the middle section that's so beautiful that was in, for example, the film Elvira Madigan. Because you just have the crystal clarity and beauty of what Mozart saw, which was absolutely stunning in its conception.
Thank you.
the music of Mozart. On Sunday night, a selection of our guest, Os Guinness, author of The Case for Civility and Why Our Future Depends on It. Os Guinness, you're here in Australia talking to groups in Darwin over the past week or so. And there's a strong connection there in Australia with what's been called by the Australian press the intervention into Aboriginal affairs. Now, you're not an expert in Australian Indigenous issues, but you've come because you are concerned that we in Western countries have failed so often to deal with the needs of our Indigenous communities and what they aspire to. What you're saying about the way we as civilizations have failed in civility applies to our relationship with our Indigenous and Native communities as well.
Well, John, you said I'm not an expert. You're right. Not, worse than that, I'm an ignoramus about your local issues, and I won't pretend for a second to go there, because I've been invited to speak on the global impact of the modern world on issues like Christian education. And we have people here from scores of countries, Australians, New Zealanders, but many from Africa and other places. And you can see the very important part being played by Christian education today. So on the one hand, it's buffeted by Christians themselves who don't want to think at all, let alone Christianly. And then it's buffeted, of course, on the other side by aggressive atheists who want to rule out Christian faith in all areas of life. But you can see between that, far wider than the Christian church itself, many people realize it's these Christian schools which are teaching people not just to think, but to really grow up with a sense of values and citizenship. And so they're appealing not just to Christians, but to people of other faiths who want their children to be taught well in terms of values. And we have some fascinating discussions here, and I'm very encouraged by the level of the debate.
Christian schools have their own problems and are at risk of taking their own corner in the culture wars, particularly over the debate between science and religion. I mean, creationism and the teaching of creationism in Christian schools is an ongoing concern to many of those in the secular school sector. And they say, look, my only objection to Christian schools is the way they handle science. It is really appalling, and it is creating, building in their students cognitive dissonance, that as soon as those kids get old enough, they're forced to make a choice between science and their faith.
I only know the American Christian schools, but there you can see there are Christian schools and there are Christian schools. Some of them arose as a flight from the public schools and were founded on fear. Others were truly founded with the principle of faith at the core of all their thinking, you know, in sociology, biology, physics, whatever it was. And it's the second that I really love. Now, you can clearly see in the church worldwide that there are some scientists who are strongly people of faith who are in favor, say, of intelligent design, and others who really believe truly that God is using evolution as a means of process of human development. And I think that's where the argument lies. I'm not a scientist. I'm a hard scientist. I'm a social scientist. I can't solve some of those issues any more than they could venture into my fields in sociology and answer some of them. But the argument is between the intelligent design and the theistic evolutionists. And that argument is going on in a constructive way in many parts of the world today. I'm from Oxford. I was there last week. In the physics department alone, there are 13 evangelicals, and they have different views on that, but all of them are passionate about their faith and the pursuit of science. And we must remember, the idea that the wars of religion and science is a myth. Modern science was born through the matrix of the Christian faith, and particularly the Reformation. And when you go Copernicus, Kepler, Newton, these were all great people of faith, and their faith prompted them the way faith inspired Bach to write his music.
You only have to go, though, to the example that just last week was the anniversary of the monkey trial in the 1920s in Tennessee. And you see there an example of the way religion has not done its own cause well, in that William Jennings Bryan, the man who was parodied in all sorts of movies, was at one stage the great American hero, the great Democrat hero, the Cross of Gold speech. Jennings Bryan's attack was on social Darwinism, the impact on which corrosive, devil take the hindmost, dog eat dog world could be implied by social Darwinism. Yet the way religion has taken that up is to triumph some of the worst aspects of social Darwinism and identify itself with naked capitalism and go to war with the biology, which Jennings Bryan wasn't particularly concerned about.
But John, you go back to St. Augustine. He pointed out the church always makes a great mistake when it hitches its understanding of the Bible to its understanding of any period's understanding of science, because science moves on. And we've got to work out the relationship between faith and science in every generation in great ways. And I'd be the first to say that the church has often been corrupted, sometimes by sex, sometimes by power, sometimes by money, sometimes by various things. And what you're describing, the 1920s, was one of the low points of the Christian church in the United States.
What a Paul
Sweet. But as G.K. Chesterton used to say, five times the church has gone to the dogs, but each time it was the dog that died. In other words, the church has in itself, in the gospel, a principle of revival and restoration. It bounces back. So we learn from the horrors of Christendom. We can learn from the stupidities of some of the fundamentalist movements of the 1920s and later. But when we learn, we say, that isn't the gospel, and go back to the real thing, and then go forward. The church always goes forward best by going back first.
Are we at a point, and this perhaps brings some of the threads of our conversation together, where the polarization, even within the Christian community, is such as to actually be corroding away the base from which Christianity can rebound? You're seeing a collapse in church attendance. Well, you saw it in Europe 15 years ago. You're seeing it in Australia now. Church attendance has been collapsing over the last 15 years in Australia. You've seen it in Canada. Now it's beginning to impact in the United States. And much of it comes from the sort of people who ring this program and say, look, I used to go to church, but I'm sick and tired of going into communities which are just self-consumed, and I just want to get out and breathe the fresh air of the world. And that Christianity itself is involved in a defensive flight, in many cases, from engagement with the world.
No, I think that's very short-sighted, John. I understand what you're saying and what they're thinking. And I grew up in the 1950s, which is the time of that dead wood, hollow staleness in the Church of England, and many got out. But the 60s, for many of us who were still there, was the time when you had to go back to square one and really know what you believed, who you believed in, why you believed it, and you really knew for yourself that this was true and it meant everything to the whole of your life, or you didn't go on that way. And actually, I disagree with the way you described it. In many of the countries you're talking about, we have reached the bottom and we're going back. In England, the countryside is way, way behind. Many of the cities have vibrant new churches growing all over the place. My son lives in New York. 25 years ago, New York was a spiritual wasteland, highly secular. Now it's just teeming with new churches, hundreds of them planted in the last 10, 15 years. And I think, contrary to what you're saying, there's an extraordinary new growth and any number of new entrepreneurial initiatives. And actually, it's the other way around. Now, when you say leave the church and go out and breathe the fresh air, when you go deep into atheism, take Jean-Paul Sartre. He said atheism is a cruel long-term business. And I've been through it to the end. Most of the great atheists if they were brave, and many of them were, it was a bleak bravery because of the pessimism, everything from chance, and so on and so on and so on. So I don't call that fresh air. It becomes toxic at a certain point. So I would challenge people, yes, look at Buddhism, look at Hinduism, look at Islam, look at secularism. And then, by force of contrast, you see again the wonder of the Christian faith.
For the past 60 to 80 years, evangelicalism seems to have moved away from an engaged evangelical proclamation that characterizes 19th century evangelicalism into our job is to put people in the heavenly lifeboat and let the world burn in hell, literally. premillennial dispensationalism became very, very popular among many, many evangelical Christians. You see an evangelical retreat that perhaps is turning around, but it's no doubt that it's been there in many, many circles. You only have to watch the sort of religion you get on American television evangelical shows to know that that's true.
But that isn't the growing edge of evangelicalism. And again, I disagree with you strongly. Many of the best philosophers in America are evangelicals. Many of the best historians are evangelicals. Many of the best social activists are evangelicals. You can describe a part of it like that, but that in no way describes the whole. You know, and I would go further than that. And for 30 years, I've been a steadfast critic of much of the vulgarity, shallowness, and anti-intellectualism of evangelicalism. But the trouble is much of it hasn't been as evangelical as it should be. Because evangelical, I think it's actually deeper than Catholic and deeper than Orthodox. To be evangelical is to be defined by the good news proclaimed by the kingdom of God through Jesus. And that is fundamental and primary, and many people are returning to that in a radical way. And part of the huge growing edge of the church in many parts of the world is evangelical.
But didn't evangelicalism lose its connection with the point that you were making right at the start, that in some ways Christianity is deeply civilizational? It's profoundly civilizational. And by cutting yourself off and saying, look, our job is not to transform the world, but just to save souls and get them into heaven,
but
evangelicalism lost its connection with the world.
But John, who teaches that now? I haven't heard anything like that for 40 years. But it's still attacked, and I think it's a straw man. I really do. I haven't heard that for a long, long time. I know N.T. Wright's a good friend of mine, and he's taken off on a lot of this. And I don't know who he's talking about in practice. None of my friends, none of the churches I know, would preach anything like that. They're deeply engaged in society. Now, my own criticism would be that, say, the Christian right has been engaged in society, but in the world's way, not Christ's way. Unlike, say, William Wilberforce, who did the Lord's work in the Lord's way, as they put it back then. So I know an evangelicalism that's deeply involved in a thousand areas of cultural engagement. I simply don't know what some of these people are attacking, although it makes good press.
Well, you say the Christian right has problems. What would you identify the problems of the Christian right in being in the way they approach? And to give them credit, they are the people who 30 years ago began to say our religion must be connected to the way our state expresses itself. What's the critique you offer of the way the religious right behaves?
Put it this way simply, John. In the 20th century, two-thirds of the church and the time were privatized. Privately engaging, publicly relevant. And that was one extreme which was very wrong. In 1975, with the rise of the religious right, they went to the other extreme. And the two huge problems over the last 30 years, first, they were politicized. They trusted to politics to do what politics can't do. You know the old maxim, the first thing to say about politics is that politics is not the first thing. And they thought that if you just put our people in power, you take the Bush administration, Bush 2, you had the president, the secretary of state, two attorney generals, the speaker of the house, the majority leader, the minority leader, and so on. Every one of them was described as inept, and one of them is going to jail for being corrupt. We had, quote, our people there, and they were a disaster. That's politicization. The other problem is they tried to do, as I put it earlier, the Lord's work, but in the world's way. Christian right has fear-mongered. It has demonized its enemies. Jesus told us to love our enemies. The most repeated refrain in the whole of the Bible is, have no fear. So the Christian right has been a terrible blot. We may take 50 years in America getting over the damage of the Christian right.
It continues in the current climate change debate. I think the Pew Forum did a research piece a few months ago which suggested that it was strange that people who were going to church, evangelicals going to church, were more sceptical on climate change issues than were the general population.
Well, sadly, John, it's another area where they're not thinking Christianly. And that's probably because they're Republican. And the Republican Party has been dominated by corporate interests which are against any of the thinking about being green. And that's why much of America is in denial about the state of the earth in a very, very dangerous way. And sadly, Christians are caught up in it. Now, it's not because they're thinking Christianly, but because they aren't.
There's a populist anti-intellectualism abroad too, which hitches itself, as in Glenn Beck and others, to a religious sensibility.
Well, you know, American Christian faith, and Glenn Beck, of course, is Mormon, not Christian, but ever since the Second Awakening, it's had the temptation of populism. The First Awakening was led by intellectuals, Jonathan Edwards, John Wesley, George Whitefield, Oxford men, and so on. But the Second Awakening, the Cane Ridge revivals in Kentucky, gave this idea that the common people knew just as much. You didn't need education. You didn't trust hierarchy. You were suspicious of leaders. And evangelicals have been foolishly populist ever since. And it's disastrous. Cultural change happens through leaders rather than followers. It starts in the center of culture, not in the peripheries. And when evangelicals have gone the populist route, they've actually again denied the biblical understanding where leaders are incredibly important.
Oscar Ness, we're going to have to wind up our time here. It's been great to talk with you, but you've got to answer me one riddle first. When I mentioned that you were coming on the program, I said, isn't he connected to the Brewing Institute? Hasn't his family got connections with Hudson Taylor? And there are arguments about where the Ness family tree goes. Now, it's a distinguished family tree. Can you give us the 30-second version?
Well, John, I'm glad to clear it up, because our family is not Ness. It's actually Guinness. And it was one of my uncles who came over here to dissociate himself from the brewery. He called himself Guinness, and Australians have tended to do that since then. But Arthur Guinness, 1759, came to faith through John Wesley. And the Guinness Brewery from the beginning has been more, quote, socially responsible, more philanthropically generous than any other single corporation in history.
And relatively low in alcohol content for many years.
Relatively, and all came out of their faith. So I'm proud to be an ancestor of the Guinness family. And you know, in those days, it was called fortified lemonade, and it was the Christian answer to the gin craze, which is a very genuine social problem in the 18th century.
And there's a link to Hudson Taylor and China. Well, you, in fact, were born in China.
Well, I was born in China, and my grandfather's sister was married to Hudson Taylor's son. So she wrote the book, you know, on Hudson Taylor. Her name then was on the book was Mrs. Howard Taylor, but in fact her maiden name was Geraldine Guinness, and so our family is related by marriage. But there was no conflict between the faith and the brew.
And, of course, a long history through yourself and others into the InterVarsity Fellowship and so much that you've contributed over the years. It's been great to have you with us. Thanks for going the course on Sunday night.
Well, an enormous privilege, John. Thank you.
Sunday Night with John Cleary.
And thanks to Oz Guinness. Corrected.